Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values, stories that shape us, and how we can learn to engage better across our deep differences. Every episode, I speak to someone with some kind of public voice, ask them about what they believe and what they have learnt about how we can have better encounters across our divides. In this episode, I spoke to Mary Harrington. Mary is a psychotherapist, writer, and columnist for Unheard. We spoke about the legacy of her Steiner School, the influence of postmodernism on mental health, the challenges of speaking of motherhood in public, and what exactly is post-liberalism. I hope you enjoy listening. Mary, we're going to kick off straight in the deep end, talking about the sacred, this big hefty word. People react to it in all manner of different ways, which I find really interesting. When you were given some warning that I'd asked you about your sacred value, what sort of thought processes has that set off in you?
Well, it's kind of a difficult thing to think about. The first thing that came to mind was that I just wanted to argue with premises, in that, you know, if you ask somebody about their personal sacred values, I think that's a contradiction in terms. In that I question the idea that sacred values are something which can be defined personally, in the sense that, you know, sacredness, sanctity, to use an older version of the same word, is something which is created collectively. You know, it's a site of social meaning. You know, churches are the spaces they are, and they have the atmospheres they have because people come into them collectively to be serious. And when people stop doing that over time, that sort of way, it withers away again. Things become sacred by virtue of sort of mass agreement that's what they are. There are values or ideas which are becoming, you know, ever more sacred, in the sense that it's ever more forbidden to speak against them. And that's happening by a process of a sort of collective decision-making process. So asking me about what my personal sacred values are is something of a contradiction in terms. You know, I can tell you what I would struggle to get over in a personal friendship. You know, I can sort of derive some things from that, but they seem very big and very abstract, and sort of not especially meaningful in a wider social context. So I think if we're talking about the sacred in the sense of what brings people together, it's not really up to me, in a sense. You know, I live within the sacred values of the society that we all inhabit, you know, and I might have a more or less ambivalent relationship to some of them, but that doesn't change the fact that I live within that matrix of values and beliefs.
You're very right, of course, and I always think Durkheim would be rolling in his grave at the idea that I'm asking individuals about their sacred values. So maybe a better question for you would be, what do you observe? What do you think is sacred in 21st century British life, for example?
That's a big question. If I go silent, it's not because I've cut off or run.
It's fine. That's the joy of being able to edit out.
There's a long answer and a short answer to that. The short answer is, I think, that the sort of central sacred value that we've come to, or that we've whittled it down to, is personal freedom, which is a very paradoxical sort of a sacred value to have, because it's sort of it disappears in your hands even as you try and grab hold of it, because it's sort of it doesn't seem to have any content in and of itself. You know, it doesn't ask any one particular course of action of you. You know, in a sense, it's a sort of via negativa version of the sacred. It's a sort of sacredness defined by the absence of positive content. And that's I would argue, is having some very strange societal side effects, in the sense that, you know, it leaves us very little to sort of hang our collective meaning making from. You know, it whittles away at all of the pegs that we might once have hung those sort of social structures off. You know, whether or not you agree with them, I don't, you know, I'm not particularly keen to go back to a world where it's expected that as a woman I behave like this or like that. But equally, it's difficult to argue that, you know, those things help to structure society and to give people a sense of how they ought to behave. So we find ourselves in this strange world where, you know, there's this sort of collective agreement that we shouldn't tell anybody how they ought to behave, but at the same time we all feel a bit lost because we don't know how to behave.
There's a quote from the Harvard psychologist Robert Keegan I've come across recently that I'm sure I'm going to be quoting everywhere. Caspar Takao is a former guest who's used it in his book, and it's about the pressures of the moment, of this fragmented world, are kind of to recreate within your own head the structures of meaning that used to be held by a community. and the sort of metaphysical, moral, intellectual weight of that can be utterly crushing, because that's not really how we've just been designed to do it.
Absolutely. I think it's an unacknowledged and massive factor in this epidemic of mental health issues that we're seeing in young people, which is particularly acute in young people in liberal arts, in students of the arts and the humanities. And I think there's a reason for that. It's because, you know, nowhere else you're going to absorb, you know, more sort of, you know, undiluted form. You know, this assault on all of the sort of, you know, historical, traditional, you know, accumulated structures of meaning, you know, which might once have, as you say, structured, have, you know, organized those things for people. But, you know, through the medium of critical theory and various types of critical studies, you know, the line of argument there sort of treats all of those accumulated structures as oppressive, or as constraining, as, you know, if you like, an attack on people's capacity to create themselves according to the obligation to personal freedom. And what young people are left with as a consequence is this sort of, on the one hand, you have this obligation to curate yourself, to make yourself maximally marketable in the adult world. And on the other hand, you're given absolutely no guidance as to how to do that. And so I think it's, and on the one hand, you're reliant on the other to validate your identity. But on the other hand, being defined by another person is seen as an act of violence against you. So I think it's no wonder that these people are angry and tortured and confused and pulling down statues. You know, I think there's, of course, there are other things going on there. And I don't really want to speak out of turn, but I feel like the assault on meaning in the name of freedom, you know, is at a sort of deep structure level playing into some of that distress and some of that acting out.
I'm sure we'll circle back round to it, because I want to talk about a conversation that we've both been at least listening into and you've been very active in, which is about a kind of post-liberal conversation, which is one of the alternative movements coming out of some of this dissatisfaction, the sense that where we've got to isn't helping us thrive. But I'm going to make myself pause there to try and get a sense of you in your story of what's shaped your thinking. So I'd love to hear a bit, just maybe a few vignettes from your childhood, and particularly anything that you think is kind of formative ideas that were in the air, whether they were political or spiritual or philosophical, that shaped the woman that you are today, either in reaction against them or things that you've carried through.
Well, I mean, I went to a faith school of a sort, but it was an unusual faith school. I went to a Rudolf Steiner school, and Rudolf Steiner was either a visionary or a madman, or possibly both. We don't know, but he's one of the most influential unstudied thinkers of the 20th century. His work has been quietly phenomenally influential, but is very rarely mentioned in sort of mainstream. And he was an esoteric, he was a visionary. He claimed to be able to see the spiritual world, and he wrote at great length, enormously productive, you know, in lectures and various books about his understanding of the evolution of consciousness, the history of humanity, all the way back to before Atlantis, which he says was a real place. And what his followers and his enthusiasts have developed, you know, based on the thinking of Rudolf Steiner, is an education system. There's a method for agriculture, biodynamic farming, which write on people who are interested in sustainability have sometimes come across, but rarely in the context of Rudolf Steiner, and which includes all sorts of unusual practices like planting according to the phases of the moon, and including astrology in animal husbandry, quite unusual things. But it's a whole worldview. I mean, what I'm trying to get across is it's a whole worldview. And when you're inside it, when you grow up inside it, my mum was a teacher at the science school. It's like going to a Christian Brothers school, you know, perhaps a bit less strict. My husband actually is a lapsed Catholic. And although he went to a Christian Brothers school, and we've compared notes on the experience of growing up inside our faith, even though the faiths that we grew up in were quite different, but in a funny way, it's something that we both share. And I think when you grow up inside a faith, like a sort of faith community, I don't think you ever really deprogram yourself. And so there's almost certainly bits of my Steiner heritage which still structure the way I think about things.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So you launched out of Steiner School, you went off to study English and languages at Oxford. And then one of the things I've found really interesting about you and reassuring about you, because I'm this way too and lots of the people I know are, is you've had a real zigzag career of following interests, you know, writing on culture and being involved in an educational startup. Do you have a sense of what were the threads you were pulling on in that phase of your career?
in my 20s, I was, well, when I got to Oxford, postmodernism hit me like a ton of bricks. I wrote a long piece about that that's been sort of 20 years in the gestation. I'm not going to try and summarize it now beyond saying postmodernism, critical theory, I found it deeply disturbing coming from this sort of grand, unifying, very teleological worldview that I'd grown up in to as a sort of deconstructive perspective where everything is power and there are no stable meanings. It was sort of a borderline a psychotic experience. You know, it was like the walls were moving around. It was deeply disturbing. And it took me, I think, most of my 20s to recover from that, or at least, you know, find any way of coping with it at all. I was not the most emotionally stable person. And, you know, I wouldn't say postmodernism drove me crazy, because, you know, that was quite plausibly something which should have happened anyway. But it was the delivery mechanism for the crazy. It was the vector it took. And, you know, I think it sounds mental to say that I spent my 20s trying to find answers to the problems that threw up for me. But I think that's pretty much what I was doing. You know, I was trying to figure out whether it's possible to have a meaningful encounter with the other. I was trying to work out whether it's possible to organize and get anything done outside of hierarchies of dominance. My conclusion there, incidentally, is that no, you can't.
Tell me a bit more about that, because I'm intrigued. And, you know, some of the conversations I end up in, because I end up in lots of different conversations deliberately, is very much in that very flat hierarchical attempts to build organizations and movements without having to just recreate power, hierarchy, dominance. And I'm always intrigued by them, but have never sort of thrown myself in that direction. What were you trying to do? And I guess it's, you know, it could be a whole interview, but in short, sort of, why did you reach the conclusion you couldn't?
Well, it's not exactly that you can't. It's that, although this really is a very long conversation, I'd have to tell you, I'd have to dig back into some actually quite painful memories. When the startup collapsed, it was absolutely devastating for me. I'll just contextualize it. I lost my best friend. I lost my whole social circle. I lost pretty much, you know, the entirety of where I thought my life was going. I mean, having a business fail is a lot of people will recognize that it's an upsetting thing. But it was like, you know, the only thing I can compare it to, I've also experienced miscarriage. And it was like that. You know, it's a sort of the same kind of bereavement in the sense that it's sort of, It's not a person that's out there in the world. You know, it's a set of ideas and a set of hopes that you have and a set of possibilities that have just gone. And losing a business and the hopes that you have for that and losing a pregnancy are perhaps more closely, more alike than I ever could have imagined. So that's just to give you a context for why it's a painful area to discuss. But just to say a little bit more about power and hierarchy, because it really was we tried to organize without an organizational hierarchy. In, you know, we had five co-founders and we tried to pretend that we were all equal, but we weren't. We tried to pretend that we made decisions in a flat structure, and we didn't. And I mean, it's arguable that perhaps we just didn't have the mental or the societal software that we needed in order to have made such a sort of flat hierarchical organization work. But what I took away from the experience of having tried desperately hard to do something outside of the old-fashioned hierarchical approach and failing so spectacularly, what happened in a nutshell was that, you know, the same old power dynamics crept back in, and it's just that they were unspoken and they were unspeakable. You know, in a sense, you know, the shadow of a flat structure is a tacit hierarchy. And it became increasingly impossible to speak to that. You know, relationships soured and it became increasingly difficult to speak to that. And because of all of this was so tied up for me with my personal preoccupations and my anxieties about power and meaning and so on, you know, I became so sort of angry and despairing about the whole thing that I think I was just pretty obnoxious to work with. And I ended up basically being kicked out of the startup. It was a very painful experience. It was like my world fell apart at that point. It was brutal. And I suppose it left me with a lot of difficult questions to try and make sense of about how do you get anything done if power is inescapable, you know, if, you know, imbalances of power are an, you know, unshakable fact of life, then how do you wrestle with, on the one hand, the desire to kind of make them visible and not allow them to become oppressive, but on the other hand, the reality that they need to exist if you're going to organize beyond, you know, sort of a family unit, for example. You know, how are we supposed to exist in a complex society unless we're able to grapple with the question of power? You know, not as something oppressive that we need to destroy, but as something enabling that we can work with in order to create as well. I don't know that I'd have articulated any of that as clearly at the time. You know, I mostly went away feeling numb and bruised, and and pretty disillusioned with the whole sort of vaguely kind of, you know, Blairite left think tanky, you know, things can only get better-ish sort of a world in which the startup had been happening, and just thought, well, you know, if all of that was bullshit, then what else is bullshit? And just went and did some reading, read all the things which were verboten, and came to the conclusion that actually, you know, some of them are verboten for a good reason, but others, you know, are, you know, perhaps onto something, and you need to be given serious consideration. You know, I vowed at that point that I was just going to hang up my boots and, you know, give up politics and give up the internet and just be a sensible grown up and, you know, get a sensible job. And I left London and I got married, and that sort of, you know, put a normal life, took up my life for some years. I retrained as a psychotherapist, and that was actually life changing as well, because it helped, it answered some of the questions which I had about whether or not it's possible to have human encounters and human relationships outside this sort of, you know, the intrusions of power into everything that we do. And I think the inference I took away from the sort of critical theory, continental philosophy, if you like, was that it's impossible to have human encounters without power somehow intruding. It's impossible to meet another person in any space whatsoever without your encounter being overwritten by, you know, your different identities, and, you know, without it being overdetermined. And in a sense, you know, stripping away your agency and ability to encounter the other in any sort of authentic sense. But practicing as a therapist just really argued against that for me. Because I think one of the things that's very interesting about psychotherapy is that relational psychoanalysis particularly has met the same kind of decentering of the subject as you get in continental philosophy.
I'm going to ask you to, forgive me to cross it, I'm going to ask you to explain what that is.
Yeah, it's an idea out of deconstruction that says, you know, it's not really possible to have an objective self that, you know, that is capable of accessing truth, because in fact we're all written by our cultural backgrounds and our, you know, societal positions and our identities and so on and so forth. And as a result, you know, this objectivity, which, you know, the kind of scientific worldview, is in fact just a kind of duck blind for patriarchy, misogyny, etc., and all the rest of those. That's a very crude characterization of the argument, but that's roughly the territory. And the same questioning of whether it's possible to have an objective view or an objective analyst or comes up in psychoanalysis as well. You know, because, you know, but Sigmund Freud is very much of the opinion that the analyst can sort of separate himself, I use himself advisedly here, and take an objective perspective on what's going on for the client. But contemporary psychoanalysis is more of the opinion that, in fact, what you're creating together is a relational space in which transformation is possible, but that takes a degree of reflexivity on the part of your a part of the psychotherapist as well as the client. You know, in a sense, you have the, it takes a great deal of introspection from the therapist as well. And what becomes possible, or what I learned becomes possible through that, is transformation. I've been transformed in therapeutic encounters, but I've also transformed. I mean, I won't tell you stories because I can't, but I have letters that have been written to me by former clients, which, you know, I still can't read without welling up. It's possible. It's possible to meet the other, and for beautiful things to happen. And that very nihilistic postmodern argument that, in fact, you know, that's, we're all just atoms spinning out on our own. It's not true.
It's so interesting, this conversation, Mary, for lots of reasons. One is, it's helping me make sense of something I can't fully articulate, but it's the way, the sort of fundamental thread that we are pulling at is so similar in lots of different tribes and conversations, and just expressed very differently. You know, this I'm a huge Martin Buber fan, and this sense of the I, thou, this encounter with God, which is Buber's main concern, actually, which often gets overlooked, but also real moment of encounter with other, the way that's the sort of bedrock of so much theology, but also in with my kind of spiritual but not religious friends, this sense of the things that get in between the intimacy of human encounter and create these kind of barriers of loneliness. And then in the policy and the politics world that I'm also in, although it's much more instrumental, pragmatic language, these, you know, that is when you really strip it off and everyone sort of slightly drops their professional guard, it's this sense that the way we're living is not human or humane, because we're creating structures that keep us from each other and keep us from our true selves. And yeah, I'm just thinking about what would it mean to kind of bust out of some of those silos and see the existential questions under things. But I'm going to park that thought and try and ground this conversation in something quite specific. One of the threads that we pull on is, I've used that phrase a lot today, it sounds like a tapestry weaver, is about public conversations and where they're tricky across difference and how can we do them better. And I first came across your writing, and actually, if you Google you, it's the first thing that comes up, your piece from, I think, late last year on motherhood and why motherhood began to undermine this sense of identity you had as someone who was a kind of broadly left liberal feminist in a sort of broad way. And I became a mother nearly 6 years ago and had a similar moment of like, gosh, the feminism that I thought I held has just completely changed colour. And why is this experience so entirely absent from art and culture and our narratives? And yet even in feminist circles, trying to talk about it feels like you're somehow letting the side down. Tell me about the lead up to that piece and what your kind of experience has been of trying to talk thoughtfully and carefully about motherhood in public.
Well, I mean, the reaction I got to that piece was surprisingly popular. It was surprisingly positive. I was expecting at least somebody to say horrible things about how I was some sort of awful reactionary, or I don't know, that trying to take women back to the dark ages or send us back to the kitchen. Or, you know, I tried very, very hard to hedge what I was saying by, you know, emphasizing that's really not what I'm advocating, either for myself or anybody else. But it's a problem. There are some real tensions between the embodied experience of being a mum and the cultural context that we have, and what's valued in the culture that we have, and particularly the emphasis that we have on personal development, individual freedom, and quite a sort of what I think is quite a limiting idea of what freedom means. Because, you know, there's once when if you're breastfeeding, for example, there is no meaningful sense in which when your baby is screaming for milk at 3 a.m., you can turn over and go back to sleep because I don't want to. Because I don't want to, which I think is sort of is something that really comes is front and center, particularly in childbirth and caring for a new baby, you know, and the sort of just the bodily nature of it. You know, you really do switch off your front brain for a while. And that's just that's quite a shocking place to find yourself, you know, particularly as a, you know, university educated, you know, reasonably middle class, you know, white collar working, you know, logically thinking, I'm as cognitively capable as anybody else on this planet in Western woman, you know. So going from that to, you know, having your front brain pretty much kind of sidelined by some fairly basic animal stuff, you know, takes a bit of adjusting. It left me with some questions about the ideology within which feminism has shaped itself, I suppose. You know, whether or not actually it takes enough account of, you know, some pretty immutable realities of what it is to be female.
Mm. Yeah, the narrative that I sometimes come across is this, that, you know, to be free, we need to care less and take less responsibility for others.
Then who else is going to do it?
Yeah, and that we're somehow complicit in our own oppression because we keep caring. And what really crystallized for me around having babies and breastfeeding them and then trying to go back to work whilst breastfeeding and trying to lead an organization through two maternity leaves was this sense of I don't want to have to decenter that part of myself, but I don't want to give away all the power that I feel like I'm trying to learn to wield wisely and with authority and hopefully growing in virtue around. But even in talking about our experience as a mother, what I'm aware of is that there'll be some people listening for whom they just don't want to listen to a conversation about motherhood, which is totally fine. And one way of them very normal, but that the absence of places to talk about it, something so, it's fundamental. It's the way through which every human being arrives. Despite the kind of sensitivities around infertility or baby loss, which is some of what's driving that for, you know, very pastoral reasons, but also, yes, because I feel like this tension as a sort of woman with some kind of public voice, that people will take me less seriously if I have the part of me that is a mother front and center. And in some ways, lockdown's really helping with that because everyone who is a parent is finding it hard to hide that fact. And part of me that wants to just not talk about motherhood at all, but talk about parenthood. Because in talking about motherhood, I feel like I'm just continually reinforcing these patterns that leave women taking the majority of caring responsibilities for years after the brute biological facts would necessitate it. Sorry, that's a scrambled download of thoughts. But what do you think would be kind of a healthier conversation about motherhood and parenthood in public that would be more kind of life-giving and more human for everyone with a stake in it?
Well, I feel like lots of the pieces are there, but what we're missing is some of the connective tissue. When I say lots of the pieces are there, I think there's quite a lot of material in evolutionary psychology which we could use, which feminism could use to inform a more compassionate, embodied way of talking about motherhood. You know, but I think I understand why there's this sort of odd Chinese wall between evolutionary psychology and feminism, because it's very easy to go from a scientific paper that says, you know, this is commonly the case for males as opposed to females, to this is to this ought. And I think, you know, many women are very, very tired of hearing from reactionaries that, you know, because science says that there are some differences, normative differences between the sexes on various personality traits, that therefore that means you or I should be a certain way. You know, nobody wants to be having that conversation because it's boring and futile and it's wrong. Not to mention putting people who don't conform to those normative stereotypes in an unpleasant and sometimes dangerous position. So, you know, it's sensitive territory, but at the same time, I think we've ended up in if you go too far the other way, you end up in a situation where you pretend that there are no differences between the sexes at all, apart from their dangly bits. And that's just not, you know, self-evidently not the case. You know, anyone with eyes and a functioning brain ought to be able to see that. But politically, we're not allowed to talk about that. And there are good reasons for that and compassionate reasons for that. But that's perhaps something that we could usefully look at. You know, how can women who have women's interests at heart engage with this stuff so that it doesn't become the exclusive territory of you know, reactionary anti-feminists? Because I think certainly there's a danger of that being the case at the moment, and that's, I'm not keen on that. And I think perhaps there's somewhere in this conversation, there's a meaningful conversation to be had, and I suppose this is where we get on to post-liberalism, about limits. And this is something, you know, I'm in the phenomenally privileged position of being able to work from home flexibly and pretty much set my own hours. But regardless, my daughter's three. I'm incredibly fortunate in that I get to spend a lot of time with her. In a way, you know, I'm very lucky. I know that there's, you know, there are plenty of mothers who are not nearly so lucky and have to make, for example, you know, single mothers or, you know, people whose occupations take them out of the house. Regard, you know, there are some jobs that you can't do from home. You know, that's pretty obvious. There are probably conversations that we can have about limits. You know, for me, I've found that there's a hard limit on the amount of time I can spend away from my daughter without the connection between us suffering. You know, I don't think I'm alone in that as a mum. You know, if I wanted to make different trade-offs, I could allow that connection to attenuate. I could, you know, not find it so easy to tune into what she needs or wants at any given point. And, you know, and outsource that to a nanny or some other caretaking person, or perhaps a father, or who knows. You know, different people take different decisions, but it's important to me that that connection stays strong and well tended. And because of that, I've decided, sometimes reluctantly accepted that there are hard limits on the amount of time I can spend doing my work. And that's just the reality of it. And it will probably change as she gets older. But while she's little, that just is the way it is. So I think there's a piece in there about limits as well, and how you balance those different trade-offs. You know, and again, this assumes that you have the personal freedom, you know, even to be able to make those decisions with any degree of control. And in that, I'm phenomenally privileged. But you know, if we're talking here really about professional class liberated Western graduate women, then I think this is a set of trade-offs that a lot of mothers face. And yeah. I think perhaps it's, you know, within what I was saying is the sort of narrowly understood take on freedom. You know, those questions are very difficult even to ask, because, you know, how dare you suggest that there even are any limits?
Yeah. So let's talk about post-liberalism then. And you write for Unheard, you're a columnist for Unheard, which is this online news outlet that is a sort of, I'm not sure they'd use this kind of technical term, but they're trying to not be politically boxed as left wing or right wing. And certainly a lot of the people that write for them are beginning to cluster around this term post-liberal. And from the outside, as a kind of interested observer, I sometimes write for Unheard too, it seems to me to be a kind of evolution of what was known as a kind of red Tory / blue Labour flowering pre George Osborne, basically, and have some of those similar threads. But it's had a spike in interest because Danny Kruger, who's a new Conservative MP, made his maiden speech about it. There are a few things in the Times about it. It feels to me like a kind of political thing that there's growing interest in. And even as someone who's sort of reasonably close to it and temperamentally open to the possibility that there's useful ideas there, I still don't even really know how to define it. I know you've written more on it than I have. What is it, and how did you get there?
I'll answer the second first. The second question: how did I get there? By accident. I'm a great lover of internet rabbit holes. My hobby is internet rabbit holes. I follow my interests and read up on things that I find interesting, and, you know, cumulatively over a period of some years, I suppose, probably starting around Cameron era, maybe a little bit before, I guess, you know, from the Great Crash onwards, I just found myself again pursuing this line of inquiry. You know, if that was a load of rubbish, then what else is? And, you know, I found myself following up with a particular interest in perspectives which were neither straightforwardly conservative nor orthodox left, and that covered quite a wide range of writers. But But yeah, I mean, post-liberal is a difficult idea. It's not a very useful term in a way, because it defines itself in terms of its, I don't want to say its enemy, because it's not really, you know, certainly I don't think of myself as the enemy of liberalism. You know, I am basically a liberal, you know, in most respects. You know, I'm pretty straightforwardly liberal in many regards. I mean, the only difference really I see between myself and any other sort of bog standard liberal is that, you know, I'm uncomfortably aware that there are some costs to liberalism, and I'm trying to be intellectually honest, I suppose, in my writing about exploring what some of those costs are, and, you know, following that line of reasoning a bit. You know, I ask these questions because I don't really want to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater, I suppose. You know, and I'm concerned that, you know, if by accident, by, you know, not hedging against sort of, you know, unintended consequences, you know, in our sort of headlong pursuit of personal freedom, we end up somewhere, you know, that actually isn't very free, or isn't very social, or isn't very liberal, in fact. You know, and I wouldn't be the first person to suggest that, you know, in some respects, that's where we are, or that's where we're heading at the moment as a society. I realise I haven't answered at all the question of what post-liberalism
is. What is it?
Yes. But I suppose, you know, I say the only thing that distinguishes me from a liberal is that I'm keen to count the costs. And, you know, I said to somebody else the other day that the only thing that distinguishes me from a conservative is that I don't like some of my conclusions. Well, I suppose if it's, you know, I'm sort of mentally running through post-liberals that I know, and they vary enormously, you know, from sort of gay atheist post-liberals with a kind of European sensibility through to sort of hardline, quite socially conservative Catholics. It's heavily Catholic in its inflection. You know, a lot of American post-liberals come from a Catholic background. But I think if they have a sort of shared trait, it's probably a willingness to consider questions of the social, and whether or not the social, you know, imposes constraints on individuals.
Mary, I'm going to ask you a final question that I ask everyone, and for some people, it's very easy to frame what divides they sit on and what they've learnt about crossing them. It's not at all easy to frame for you, which is probably why I like your writing. And you have been part of and continue to be part of and questioning multiple tribes on lots of different axes. But, you know, you are trying to write in public about things that are difficult to navigate and are easy to say stupid things about, and are easy to be hateful about, basically, which is why they're hard to write about and why lots of people don't try. What have you learned about what, I guess maybe as a psychotherapist, but primarily as a columnist, what enables us to have those encounters, that enables us to grow in understanding of each other, even if we're different, even if we disagree with each other, rather than just continually triggering each other into these defensive reactions, which seems to me to be the mode that we're generally stuck in public debate?
I mean, it's probably too pat to say get off social media, but to be honest, I think social media is absolutely pernicious, and the more short form the better, or the worse rather, in that respect. It's funny, I was thinking about this earlier today. I think the internet is, you know, has enormous potential to spread ideas and, you know, allow exchange of views and so on and so forth, but it fails in thinking of, you know, the shortcomings of the internet. It's great for sharing information. It's great for sharing knowledge and ideas. Where it fails is in allowing emotion to be conveyed and received in any sort of sincere or kind or generous way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even worse than the loss of nuance on the telephone, where you can't see somebody's face. But the loss of nuance in writing, especially where there are constraints on characters, is an enormous contributor, I think, to the sort of polarization of political debate. And, you know, sometimes I watch, somebody started one of these futile debates with me the other day. They picked me up on something that I said on Twitter and misread it in an uncharitable way. I responded saying, well, no, that isn't what I meant, whereupon they came back and misread my response in an uncharitable way. And I looked at it and I thought, this could go on for the rest of my afternoon and eat all my emotional energy. I don't have time for that because I've got to go and cook tea for a three-year-old soon. And I just don't do this. So I wished them good day and just went and did something else. And that's incredibly hard to do. And I don't want a medal for doing it because there are plenty of times when I've succumbed. We all succumb. And I feel like there's something very deep. There's a real yearning going on, you know, and all of these people who are you know, fighting each other on the internet. I feel like behind it, there's a yearning for connection. There's a yearning for recognition. And there's a yearning to be understood. And when it's knocked back again and again and again, because you can never really be fully understood except in a face-to-face encounter. And even then it's incredibly difficult because it takes reflexivity and it takes charity and it takes a willingness on both sides to try. And so what you have this sort of magnification of, you know, of different ways you can be misunderstood and, you know, an ever more constrained, you know, field in which you're trying to be understood and an ever more desperate yearning to be understood. And then it sort of curdles into this kind of rancid kind of, you know, babel of acrimony on the internet. So, you know, in answer to what do I think we could do in order to understand one another better? Part of the answer is get off social media. And the other part of the answer is accept that sometimes we won't be understood. You know, do our best to read charitably, do our best to read whatever it is that we're reading in the most, in, you know, try and assume that the other person is meaning well. Don't assume bad faith. Even if it is bad faith, it doesn't really matter. But if you assume good faith, then you might get a little bit further. And then also accept the fact that, you know, sometimes you're not going to be understood, and actually that's painful. Mm. Not that that's okay, because it's painful. And be able and willing to walk away.
I now will have that song, which I'm going to resist singing, but the lyric goes, I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. And it does feel like that's a good anthem. Mary Harrington, thank you so much for talking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Soup Shop Productions, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at @sacred_podcast or me at @theoselizabeth or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.